You're listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Bridge coming to you from IRIB English Radio. When we are looking at ourselves and we see and we get to realize that I'm not happy, there are things going wrong with me. And when people sometimes get sad and stressed and depressed, they try to find answers, but sometimes they look in the wrong places. They think that they are depressed and sad. What I'll do is I'll go pleasure myself. I'll go, I don't know, make money. I'll go entertain myself. I'll go eat. I'll go this, I'll go that. And obesity obviously is one of the causes where people keep eating more and more and more. So what happens is there's lack of contentment. The person himself from within is not content. So don't seek the answers outside. Rather seek them within you. Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he gives the perfect remedy for that. He says, "Al-mustarihu min al-nas al-qana." Amongst the people who is completely relaxed, completely calm, completely satisfied from within, he has no issues whatsoever, nothing can affect him, he who is content. And he who is content, it means he who has more iman, he who is moving towards Allah rather than this dunya. And then again, salamullah alayhi, he says, "Al-qani'u najun min al-afat." He who is content is saved from all types of calamity and problems. He's not stressed anymore. He's not worried anymore. What is the worst that could happen to me? If I'm content, I will say this. What is the worst that could happen to me? Die of hunger? Well, what's the big deal? I go to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I don't have a house? What's the big deal? The worst thing that can happen to a person is death, and death itself is inevitable, something I and you cannot avoid. So why should I and you stress about life, and stress about things, and stress about wealth, and stress about this, and stress about that, and constantly worried, constantly not comfortable? We're having, you know, difficulty sleeping, and people pump too much pills in just to suppress the feelings that they have. It's becoming a problem because we are not content. So the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran, they direct our attention towards contentment. Be happy. Say, "Oh Allah, you know, whatever I have is more than enough for me." But having said that is one thing. But you have to move towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to gain contentment. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shaykh Al-Musawi in the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را هرگز مخواد از کف دهن عشق و تولای تو را یا
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
An air raid siren over the separatist-held Donetsk. The Ukrainian army shells this city every day. School 22, an old building. It survived World War II, but not this conflict.
Earlier today, it was reported that two people were killed here, but that's been updated now. Three killed and five injured. And that's just one of the strikes that have happened here in Donetsk today.
My daughter studied here. Luckily, children are studying from home. The teachers were wounded. It's horrible. I don't know where my child is going to study. There's nothing you can comment upon. It's beyond human understanding. They are simply fascists who are trying to eliminate us. That's all. They just want to kill all Donbass people.
Another school nearby also hit. It's clear these institutions have been specifically targeted. There is blood on the pavement.
Yes, we had a horrible day today. We were working when the missile hit. It was big. One person died. Two are injured. One person's in hospital now. It's a very sad situation. For some reason, peaceful civilians are targeted and they hit schools.
They just do not consider us to be human. They're only civilians here, children, women and old people. We're separatists for them. We're non-human for them. Let it be in no man's land. That's their attitude.
Now, I've covered the strikes by the Ukrainian military on civilian targets here in Donetsk, quite a few of those strikes. But this one here and the one at the other school are on a completely different scale. The ammunition used is far larger. The potential death toll of strikes like this, far greater.
Workmen have put the shell casings on the back of a lorry. The Donetsk People's Republic say this is a 155mm shell, fired by the American-supplied M777 howitzer. 108 of these weapons were delivered to Ukraine by the US. Some have now reached the front line, meaning Ukraine can now blow up schools at a further distance.
If it's proven that NATO weapons were used, what would you say to NATO countries?
They act in a wrong way. Let them come here and see what they give to Ukraine, which is used against us. Let them come and see. I wish in this moment they were here, so they could feel it themselves.
In a battered geography classroom, there's a map of Great Britain and some flags. Today, the children who attend class here are being taught a different lesson about NATO countries, that their weapons are being used to target and kill civilians. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
The British Parliament is in recess, but the letters are coming in. Only a week after a damning report by Sue Gray into Downing Street parties and Chancellor Rishi Sunak's £15 billion to help with the soaring cost of living.
The high command of the Conservative Party are in Operation Distraction now, with handouts, with talk about the Ukraine war and many other things too. But the party is currently in Operation Frustration. They elected Boris Johnson to be a great asset when it came to winning votes. At the moment, he's losing them votes.
So far this week, three more letters of no confidence, including one from former Attorney General Jeremy Wright, who said that with regret he concluded that for the good of this and future governments, the Prime Minister should step down. 37 MPs have now publicly questioned the Prime Minister's position. Out of those, two don't think he should go yet, eight are on the fence, and 27 want him to go now.
For a vote of no confidence to take place, 54 Conservative MPs will have to request it. But it's impossible to know exactly how many of them have already handed in their letters of no confidence because it's all done in secret. And some MPs are saying they're going to wait until after the Queen's Platinum Jubilee, celebrated this week, before they decide if Boris Johnson has to resign.
There isn't a clear successor to him that might bring them electoral advantage. And while they talk about the Jubilee, let's wait after that, they've mentioned the same thing about the Sue Gray report, about the police inquiry. In reality, they're waiting to see if this finally dies down or if this is a chronic condition like malaria rather than COVID that never goes away. And if it doesn't go away for Boris, then Boris is going to have to go away from the Conservatives.
There is also a question mark over what went down during COVID lockdowns in the Prime Minister's private apartment at the time. Allegations of another gathering on the day of Boris Johnson's birthday. But all eyes will be on the outcome of the upcoming by-elections beyond London, following the resignations of two disgraced Conservative MPs. Wakefield MP Imran Ahmed Khan, found guilty of sexually assaulting a teenage boy in 2008, and Tiverton and Honiton MP Neil Parish for watching pornography in Parliament. If the Tories lose, a ballot on Johnson's leadership is almost certain. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Meeting in Brussels, EU leaders have agreed to place an embargo on 75% of Russian oil imports, increasing to 90% by the end of the year. 4 weeks ago, Moscow cut off gas supplies to EU countries Poland and Bulgaria. Now Russian gas to energy firms in Netherlands, Denmark and Germany is being switched off. EU leaders say they won't back down and will continue to send arms to Ukraine.
Since the beginning of the war, leaders and the member states stepped up and announced by now 200 billion euros in extra military spending.
It is clear that most citizens don't support the move.
We are still just speaking about sanctions, giving arms and stuff. We need to speak about peace and diplomacy.
I'm against spending more and more money for weapons. Because that is only going to end up in more conflict, because the only purpose of weapons is to use them against somebody else.
Amid criticism from US war hawks, German and French leaders have been defending their decision to keep lines of communication open with the Kremlin.
I do endorse discussing with Vladimir Putin on a regular basis, with very demanding approach and full transparency with President Zelensky.
Many analysts suggest the West created this crisis by not listening to Russia's security concerns, and apparent efforts to reach out to Moscow recently are merely a charade. EU leaders have now returned to their capitals, but senior officials here at the European Commission have told Press TV that work is well underway on a seventh round of sanctions targeting Russia. Peace activists continue to ask the question, why does all the emphasis seem to be on escalation rather than diplomacy? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
For the first time since the presidential vote, France's unions marched nationwide, as the nation's public services will likely be under major attack for the next 5 years. Polls show President Emmanuel Macron will likely have almost as strong a grip over parliament as in his first term.
Unions repeatedly warned that the coronavirus was being instrumentalized to accelerate the long-standing neoliberal goal of defunding public services. Now they face a re-elected Macron who could be more powerful and confrontational than ever.
Macron's policies have meant the ending of so many social services and not replacing public servants who retire. This means those still working are doing double the amount of work as before, and that has led to burnout, illness, and even suicide attempts. If Macron would come talk to us, he would see that we are not being treated fairly, but I doubt he will.
New data shows the French economy has stagnated to the brink of a recession. Inflation in the Eurozone just hit its highest annual level since the currency began in 1999. That combination spells stagflation, something for which liberal economics has no theoretical remedy, and it comes after a decade of austerity measures which were allegedly supposed to strengthen the Eurozone.
The inflation index point has not been changed in a decade for civil servants, so our salaries have been constantly falling, and this was before this year's record increase in inflation. On top of this, they are asking us to work longer for the same pay, so our hourly wage is being reduced and we have less time away from work to be with our family and friends.
Despite the new lows in economic data, unions were not able to draw as many to march as in years past. Since the coronavirus restrictions began to be lifted last fall, many have noted that French protests are occurring less often and are smaller in size. It could be that, after a decade of mostly failed labor efforts, workers simply can't afford to miss work anymore. Or many have given up trying to influence Brussels or the French government. Or many French could be too scared to protest given what happened to the Yellow Vests. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
The British Parliament is in recess, but the letters are coming in. Only a week after a damning report by Sue Gray into Downing Street parties and Chancellor Rishi Sunak's £15 billion to help with the soaring cost of living.
The high command of the Conservative Party are in Operation Distraction now, with handouts, with talk about the Ukraine war and many other things too. But the party is currently in Operation Frustration. They elected Boris Johnson to be a great asset when it came to winning votes. At the moment, he's losing them votes.
So far this week, three more letters of no confidence, including one from former Attorney General Jeremy Wright, who said that with regret he concluded that for the good of this and future governments, the Prime Minister should step down. 37 MPs have now publicly questioned the Prime Minister's position. Out of those, two don't think he should go yet, eight are on the fence, and 27 want him to go now.
For a vote of no confidence to take place, 54 Conservative MPs will have to request it. But it's impossible to know exactly how many of them have already handed in their letters of no confidence because it's all done in secret. And some MPs are saying they're going to wait until after the Queen's Platinum Jubilee, celebrated this week, before they decide if Boris Johnson has to resign.
There isn't a clear successor to him that might bring them electoral advantage. And while they talk about the Jubilee, let's wait after that, they've mentioned the same thing about the Sue Gray report, about the police inquiry. In reality, they're waiting to see if this finally dies down or if this is a chronic condition, like malaria rather than COVID, that never goes away. And if it doesn't go away for Boris, then Boris is going to have to go away from the Conservatives.
There is also a question mark over what went down during COVID lockdowns in the Prime Minister's private apartment at the time. Allegations of another gathering on the day of Boris Johnson's birthday. But all eyes will be on the outcome of the upcoming by-elections beyond London, following the resignations of two disgraced Conservative MPs. Wakefield MP Imran Ahmed Khan, found guilty of sexually assaulting a teenage boy in 2008, and Tiverton and Honiton MP Neil Parish for watching pornography in Parliament. If the Tories lose, a ballot on Johnson's leadership is almost certain. Saeed Purizep, London.
A British government minister has launched a direct attack on the pro-Palestine boycott campaign against Israel, claiming that the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement fuels anti-Semitism, including hate crimes in Jewish-rich areas of London. Speaking while visiting Orthodox Jewish community leaders in North London, Community Secretary Michael Gove was quoted by a pro-Israel newspaper stating,
"The BDS campaign is not about running an ethical foreign policy. The BDS campaign is designed for only one purpose, to attack and delegitimize the state of Israel and the idea that there should be a Jewish state at all. The campaign has not only undermined efforts for peace in the Middle East, it also leads to community tension in the UK. We have seen an increase in anti-Semitic incidents, and the BDS campaign is a driver of that."
Founded in 2005, the BDS movement is a Palestinian-led campaign promoting boycott and economic sanctions against Israel. Pro-Israel groups have long lobbied British authorities to act against the practice. Those demands appear to have been answered, with plans announced to ban economic and cultural boycotts of Israel, with new anti-BDS legislation announced during the Queen's speech on May the 10th, a move slammed by pro-Palestine activists.
First and foremost, I think Israel is really concerned with its accesses against the Palestinians, and the civil society is rising up against that. This concern obviously means that the supporters of Israel want to make sure that Israel can continue with its occupation, and they want to close down all potential avenues that highlights the Israeli aggression and human rights violation. And therefore, we see the British government, the Conservative government, who's very close to Israel, to stop the British citizens from trying to carry out their democratic right.
Since the Queen's speech, several government ministers have targeted the BDS. Just last week, Home Secretary Priti Patel branded the BDS racist during a talk at a pro-Israel event.
According to Mr. Gove, the anti-BDS legislation will be put forward to the House of Commons before the end of this year. The move, described as a chilling attack on democracy, will also potentially face legal challenges, meaning that the fight for Palestine here in the UK is far from over. Robert Carter, London.
On Monday, head of the Iranian Islamic Seminaries, Ayatollah Ali Reza Arafi, held meetings with the head of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis, and high-ranking prelates at the Vatican. the prominent Iranian cleric, presented the pontiff with refined artifacts from his hometown of Maybod in Yazd province and the holy city of Qom. After that, the two religious personalities held private talks. Iran and the Vatican established full diplomatic ties in 1954, and the bond has remained uninterrupted ever since. Not many reflect on the fact that Iran and the Vatican both represent spiritual traditions that have much more in common than might initially come to mind. Ayatollah Rafi's visit to the Holy See coincided with the commemorations of the 33rd anniversary of the demise of Imam Ruhollah Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran. On Sunday evening, Rafi paid a visit to the Imam Mahdi Islamic Center, where he met with members of Rome's Shia community. Here, the cleric attended a commemoration of the late leader of Iran's 1979 revolution.
All thinkers who came before Imam Khomeini had predicted an end for the age of spirituality, and faithful from all religions, including the Muslims, had lost hope in the spiritual ways of living. Imam Khomeini took Islam and all religions to a more elevated spirituality, restoring their hope.
The commemoration held at the Imam Mahdi Islamic Center was also attended by Iran's diplomats and representatives of Rome's Palestinian community. There was much anticipation at the center for Ayatollah Arafi's visit.
Ayatollah Arafi's visit to Italy and to our center is very meaningful. We are honored to have him with us, and this spurs us to further study the thinking of Imam Khomeini and to ask ourselves what the role of the Shias is in the community.
In November 2020, Ayatollah Rafi sent a letter to the Holy See in which he expressed his concerns regarding the insults made against the Prophet Muhammad and the hatred expressed by some magazines, journalists, and political figures in different societies. In response to this letter, 3 months later, Pope Francis replied to the Iranian cleric, saying he is concerned for those affected by aggression and insults of religious figures, symbols, and sentiments. Max Civili, Rome.
Families of prisoners and their advocates staged a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in the blockaded Gaza Strip. Their action was in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and detention centers, including more than 500 administrative detainees. Palestinian administrative detainees have been boycotting Israeli regime courts for more than 5 months to protest their administrative detention. Administrative detention is incarceration without trial or charge and has no time limit.
Administrative detainees are subjected to extreme suffering inside Israeli jails. They've been boycotting Israeli courts for more than 150 days to protest the detention without charge. Administrative detention is a racist policy and only causes pain and suffering to Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners suffer from inhumane treatment inside Israeli jails and are being denied basic rights. Since the beginning of this year, Israeli regime forces have arrested some 3,000 Palestinians, including children and women.
Administrative detention is a systematic policy by the Israeli regime to hold Palestinian prisoners behind bars without trial for a very long time. Administrative detention can be renewed indefinitely, and it inflicts psychological pressure on the prisoners. We have all suffered from administrative detention inside Israeli jails.
During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Ministry of Detainees Affairs slammed the inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention.
We call on all international human rights organizations to come out of their silence and exert pressure on the Israeli regime to stop the inhumane administrative detention policy. Palestinian prisoners are freedom fighters and must be treated according to international laws and norms. The Israeli regime is violating conventions regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Rights activists say Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails will continue to suffer as long as the world keeps turning a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of their rights.
According to Palestinian prisoners' advocacy groups, the Israeli regime has arrested around 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Most of these detainees have been held with no charge or trial. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The UN bodies warn that factors connected to malnutrition in Afghanistan are going up every month. Millions are struggling with poverty and hunger, and thousands of others are going unemployed. Rising prices are adding to the difficulties of families to provide food.
All these 200 people are unemployed, including me. We have to pay for our houses' rents, treatment and medications, and provide food for our families. I have a family of 10. We can't afford flour, oil or rice due to soaring prices. Most of us can't even have a single meal per day. We should have jobs or receive relief funds.
With the given situation, UNICEF warns that 1.1 million Afghan children are expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition this year. Officials at the Indira Gandhi Children's Hospital said that the number of malnourished children in Afghanistan is rapidly increasing, and urgent action is needed to avert the catastrophe.
The increasing number of children at risk of malnutrition is published, which is more than 1 million. What should be done? I urge the UN and international bodies to help Afghans avert this disaster. I hope they consider us as a member of the international community and give us our rights. In particular, we need them to free our frozen funds and separate the health sector from politics.
Due to poverty, most Afghan mothers do not have proper nutrition during pregnancy. Neither can afford enough after birth.
I used to give my child some bread and tea. I was unable to breastfeed her because we couldn't afford food for ourselves. We are coming from poor families. Her father is left jobless at home. My child was constantly losing weight and cried a lot. I knew it was all because of hunger, so I brought her here.
After the Taliban seized power in August 2021, the U.S. and its allies froze about $9 billion in Afghan assets and cut off international funding. This move has partly crippled a system that was already dependent on aid. Malnutrition is a threat to children across Afghanistan. This as the country is suffering from the shortage of medicines, with hospitals being overwhelmed by hungry babies and mothers. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
After watching the tragedy at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, unfold after so many other shootings in recent weeks, I'm wondering what I might have missed when I was asked to start the FBI's active shooter program 10 years ago. Did I have my team focus on the wrong problems? Did I spend my budget wisely to find ways to save lives? The article you're about to hear has been written by Catherine Schwate, an FBI special agent who created and ran the agency's active shooter program after the shootings at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut in 2012. Catherine Schwait retired in 2017 after 20 years of service. The article has been published in the opinion section of the New York Times and is titled, "I Created the FBI's Active Shooter Program. The officers in Uvalde did not follow their training." After watching the tragedy at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, unfold after so many other shooting incidents in recent weeks, I'm wondering what I might have missed when I was asked to start the FBI's active shooter program 10 years ago. Did I have my team focus on the wrong problems? Did I spend my budget wisely to find ways to save lives? Every shooting is evaluated in three parts. How could we have prevented the shooting? Did we respond effectively to save lives? And how are we helping the community to recover? Last Monday, the FBI designated 61 shooting incidents in 2021 as active shooter attacks, up from 40 in 2020, and 30 incidents in 2019. We aren't preventing the shootings, I realized. Perhaps I thought we were doing better in responding to the attacks as they unfolded. But if the 78 minutes that the police in Uvalde, Texas waited before confronting the gunman at the Robb Elementary School are any indication, the answer is, we are not. Waiting so long, the director of the Texas Department of Public Safety said on Friday, was the wrong decision, period. So why did the police leadership make that call? In the first few years after the massacre at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut in December of 2012, the FBI spent more than $30 million to send agents to police departments around the country. The goal was to train local police officers in how to handle active shooter incidents so they would know how to go after a shooter with confidence and neutralize the threat. The day after the FBI released its latest active shooter figures, the Robb Elementary School was attacked. In the past 2 years, the Uvalde School District has hosted at least two active shooter trainings, according to reporting by the New York Times. One of them was 2 months ago. Current protocol and best practices say officers must persistently pursue efforts to neutralize a shooter when a shooting is underway. This is true even if only one officer is present. This is without question the right approach. We need to understand why that protocol was not followed in Uvalde, Texas. I'm still confident the FBI's focus on training to this standard was right. But I'm less confident in its execution. The police officers who responded may have been unprepared for conflict, which can lead to fatal results. Law enforcement officers need to be mentally prepared before they arrive on the scene, so they can respond immediately. Repetitive training builds practice and confidence. Big gatherings for training every few years are more expensive and less effective for muscle memory. Instead, departments should consider more virtual tabletop exercises they can run through in an afternoon. Have police officers walk through schools and talk with one another about how they would respond. Require police officers to check all their gear before they begin a shift. Last year, active shooters killed 103 people and injured 140 others in 30 states. 5 of those attacks were in Texas. Most of our more than 800,000 law enforcement officers in the United States are in small departments. This is not the first time a law enforcement agency has failed in the way it responded. At times, training can become routine and be taken less seriously in any environment, but agencies should be careful to avoid complacency. Are they undertaking the training to check a box? Police department leaders need to tell their officers today what is expected of them and to understand that Americans demand it. We also need to reevaluate how we advise students and teachers to react when an active shooter enters a school. After the Sandy Hook incident, the federal government adopted the Run, Hide, Fight model, which instructs students and teachers to run first if they can, then hide if they must, and finally, fight to survive. Today, schools at best are giving lip service to the first part of that mantra, to run. Most schools that train for a shooting incident urge their students, teachers, and other staff members to lock out or hide from a shooter, but almost never to run for their lives if they can. My friend Frank DeAngelis, a retired principal of Columbine High School in Colorado, told me he wished his students and faculty had been taught to flee. At Sandy Hook, 9 first graders survived when they were able to flee their classroom, thanks to their brave teacher, Victoria Lee Soto, who was shot and killed when she stood in front of the killer. I still have nightmares about details from school shootings in which survivors told me they huddled under their desks, hoping against logic that the shooter would not see them. It's hard to shed the images of victims' bodies found huddled under plastic tables, behind cloth partitions, or together in a group against the wall. I remember telling my children that if someone approached them in a car while they were walking, they should run as fast as they can and as far as possible. Yet in many school settings, we have mistakenly discouraged students from trying their best to simply stay alive. Now my youngest child is a teacher whose middle school classroom is near the end of a hall with a side door to the outside. The classrooms are filled with desks. She knows that killers who strike schools will take advantage of opportunities to find more victims. I share my daughter's experience not to invite criticism of the actions of educators responding to lethal situations, but to underscore how vital proper training is to the survival of teachers and their students. We're told the best way to learn is from the mistakes that we make. According to data from the FBI, in recent years, the average number of casualties per active shooter attack has declined, even as the number of attacks has actually increased. I think this reflects better policing and improved public awareness. Still, police will not likely be there in the critical first minutes of an attack on a school. In the aftermath of the wrenching tragedy in Uvalde, Texas, it's clear that nearly 10 years after the Sandy Hook incident, we must ask ourselves if the training designed to safeguard us against killers in our schools is the training that is working.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosro Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Assalamu alaikum to dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. This is the teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. The program, The Teacher, is about the life and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia dignitaries, scholars, jurists, and philosophers all across the world of Islam. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Mahdavi and Shaykh Ziyani. Shaykh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Ziyani, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Today we want to talk about an outstanding faqih, muhaddis, and religious authority, Shia religious authority, who is known as Muhaddis al-Kazamaini or a muhaddis from al-Kazamiyya. He is no one but Sayyid Hassan al-Saad, the author of the magnum opus Ta'sis al-Shia la'ulum al-Islam, which is really, really one of the greatest outstanding works which has been produced or compiled by Shia scholars in the last two centuries. We'll talk about this book, but before that, I'll be happy with Sheikh Mahdavi giving us some details about the early life of Sayyid Hassan al-Sadr.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sayyid Hassan al-Sadr, he was born on Friday 29th of Ramadan, the year 1272, according to lunar calendar, in Kadhimiyya, or Kadhimain, whose father is Sayyid Hadi al-Sadr. Actually, all of these Sadr that today we are coming up with their names, they are going back to the great Sadr. So all of them from the Sadr family, which are the descendants of Imam Musa al-Kadhim. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's why they are staying in Kadhimiyya as well.
That's right.
So as it is said regarding his biography, he stayed in Kadhimiyya till he was 15 years old. He has studied Sarf, Nahv, and other classical texts of seminary school or Hauza.
Yes.
And then he moved to Najaf for 17 years. Mm-hmm. He has stayed in Najaf and benefited from the great ulama of Najaf till he reached the level of ijtihad and he got the permission of ijtihad. Then
right.
He moved to Samira.
That's right.
So we can classify his lifespan into three parts.
Yes.
First in Kadhimiyya and then in Najaf when he was studying, and he moved to Samira when he was teaching the students over there. And he benefited from the great ulama, among which we can name Mirza Shirazi, who is Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Shirazi,
yes.
Mullah Hussain Ghuli Hamedani, and the rest of the great ulama. And he got permission from all of them. And this is very important that he reached the level of ijtihad, and after that, the level of marja'iyya. People
yes.
went to him, asked for the Tawzih al-Masail, or the book of Masail al-Shar'iyya.
Yes.
But he denied writing the book and okay. accepting this position
yes.
and directed people to Sayyid Ismail al-Sadr, who was his cousin.
Mm-hmm.
So it shows the level of his akhlaq and morality.
Yes.
So as long as Sayyid Ismail al-Sadr was alive, he
okay.
didn't give any verdict,
very
any
good.
Issue, any fatwa.
Yes.
But the moment his cousin passed away, again people went to him, asked for the taking this position
yes.
of marja'iyya, and that was the moment he accepted that position and actually placed himself
yes.
as a marja.
He compiled his Risala Amaliyya by the title Ru'us al-Masail al-Muhimma
yes.
at the age of 66.
Yeah.
And it shows his humble opinion, you know, that when a person he believes is more knowledgeable than him as a marja, just, we can say, inviting the people to go and follow him. And this is really a very beautiful and respectful behavior among the Shia authorities. Okay, we know him, Sayyid Hassan al-Sadr, you know, has compiled so many books and so many works, and socioculturally and religiously he was very much active. But, you know, sometimes some works and some books are juxtaposed with the name of the author. So that's why nowadays when you say, for example, Allama or Majaddini Ayatollah Sayyid Hasan Assad, Ta'sis al-Shia la'ulum al-Islam comes to our mind. And this is juxtaposed. Let's talk a little bit about this book, Shaykh Ziya. What was the main intention of writing such a book? And what is the main content of this book?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The ending years of the 19th century and the beginning years of 20th century are the years that Muslims all over the world tried to find out their, you know, identity and to get the position that had been lost for many years or many centuries at least. So it's clear that Muslim society is consisted of different denominations.
Yes.
And because the general population of Muslim Ummah is consisted of Sunni brethren.
Yes.
So it's clear that their number is more. So their voice also was louder.
Mm-hmm.
And they had their own, you know, universities and institutions yes. established. For example, Al-Azhar was established yes. and was, you know, a well-known university at the yes. beginning years of 20th century. So that's why maybe the role of Shia scholars would, you know, be neglected at this atmosphere.
To that or point, would be spirit to say marginalized.
Yes.
Because the major population of the Shia scholars, schools, universities, and the houses all around the world were, we can say, under the supervision of our Sunni brethren. Although the Shia scholars were really active,
yeah.
but because they were a minority, we can say their voice was not that much heard. Okay?
So to the point that even a person like Georgi Zeidan, that okay. is not some figure of being biased, but as a person who is just to some, okay. you know, point, but to some degrees. But we should say that Georgi Zeidan, that was a Christian researcher, said about Muslim Ummah that the majority of Islamic works are done by Sunni scholars.
Okay.
And Shia scholars are not that much.
Has no role in compiling,
yeah.
for example, books or in different fields of studies. This is what Georgi Zeidan said. And it got its answer from the side of the Shia world and the Shia scholars, including Sheikh Agha Bozorg Tehrani and this one, I mean, Sayyid
yes.
Hasan Assad.
Okay? So that's why I quoted this story yes. to come to the question that yes. you raised.
What is the main intention
yes,
of writing such a book?
What was the main intention uh-huh. of writing such a book?
Okay.
So in this atmosphere, late Ayatollah Sayyid Hasan Assad decides to compile a book
mm-hmm.
to prove the position of Shia scholars
yes.
and to, you know, exhibit this, you know, brilliant role
mm-hmm.
In front of the eyes of the world population to see, okay, that Muslim, Sunni Muslims
mm-hmm.
have done their share,
yes.
but beside that, Shia scholars okay. are also doing their share
That's
and
right.
giving their service to the Muslim Ummah. And the fruit of this good intention is the book of Ta'sis al-Shia al-Kiram al-Funun al-Islam, or different names that are
yes.
mentioned for this
But it's
book.
Mostly known as Ta'sis al-Shia al-Ulum al-Islam or Ta'sis al-Shia in concise.
Yes.
So the book Ta'sis al-Shia talks about the role that the Shia scientists and scholars have in establishing in different fields of studies, especially the Islamic studies, isn't it?
Yeah.
And Sayyid Hasan Assad was concerned with this. So I've heard that this book has 14 chapters.
Yeah.
And each chapter is dedicated to a specific field of study, Sheikh Mahdavi, isn't it?
Yeah.
What are those fields of studies? And then what is the method of Sayyid Hasan Assad in because gathering and collecting information regarding the scholars in different fields?
Okay, as you know, if you want to consider a group as a pioneer in the field of a study, you have to look at the history of that science.
Yes.
So, for example, if we want to consider Westerners as the pioneer in any field of a study, people are going to bring up some of the examples of those who initiated the mm-hmm. beginning of those sciences.
Yes.
So we see that struggle was available between Shias and Sunnis, as my brother mentioned, Georgi Zeidan, when he is writing his book is accusing Shia of not having any contribution to Islamic studies.
Or any rich legacy, it's better to say. Any rich contribution or legacy. In terms
I think
of
better to say this one. Why? Mm-hmm. Because Islamic studies mm-hmm. has a kind of big connotation. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to Islamic studies, Georgi Zeidan mentions that Shias have no contribution to this knowledge. Okay. And what are Islamic studies? Mm-hmm. It's Naf, it is Sarf, it is Tafsir, it is yes. Tariq. All of these sciences, we are not talking about the human sciences mm-hmm. in general. We That's are not right. talking about the physics or math or geography. These yes, field yes. of studies, Georgi Zeidan is not touching them mm-hmm. because it has nothing to do with the advent of Islam. Mm-hmm. He is talking about the Islamic studies in terms of syntax, morphology, history of Islam, tafsir, usul, fiqh. So,
if the Holy Quran, akhlaq, yes. kalam, theology.
So if it right. comes to these fields mm-hmm. of study and Shias have no contribution, oh. then you might come to this point that there is no lineage, there okay. is no actually originality. So mm-hmm. because of this point, mm-hmm. he wanted to signify that mm-hmm. if you go back, you will see the Shias as initiators of these sciences.
You mean Sayyid Hasan al-Sadr
yes.
wants to answer Georgi Zeidan that who are the true pioneers and initiators yes. in these 14, we can say, fields of
yes,
studies.
Yes, that's right. It's okay. better to say Islamic okay. studies. Mm-hmm. Why? Because this is the huge contribution yeah. of Shia authors oh. in terms of establishment of Islamic studies. Okay. So he picks the Abul As'ad al-Du'ali as the student of Imam Ali alayhi salam mm-hmm. as the one who initiated the knowledge of syntax and morphology, which is Sarf and Nahw. When good. It comes to tafsir, he picks the Sayyid ibn Jubayr as the commenter and exegete, the first one. And he claims that the one, this yes. man was a Shia. Why? Because he was killed by Muawiyah. So Muawiyah was from those who were against the follower yes. of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. So he brings up his argument regarding the authors who established the knowledge, and then he proves that these authors were oh. regarded as Shias. That's so right. this is the huge contribution of Shia okay. sect.
So many historical details and information around these main characters are also given, isn't it?
Yeah,
by
definitely.
Sayyid Hasan al-Sadr yeah. in that, we can say, field. Okay, so that's all right. And it seems to be very much difficult. I mean, it starts with Ilm al-Nahw and finished in Ilm al-Akhlaq. And this is really interesting, especially for me when I was reading out and checking out the list of the titles and the content, that Akhlaq as a knowledge and as a different field of study is also included among these 14 fields of studies. And when I was checking out that why, for example, akhlaq, and what was the main reason that Sayyid Hasan al-Sadr, he says that Sayyid Hasan al-Sadr believed that Imam Ali alayhi salam was the main author and writer and the first one on the field of akhlaq. Because when he was getting back from the Siffin battle, he wrote a letter to his son. And in that letter, you can find many moral virtues and trainings and the ethical trainings. So this was really, really outstanding and really nice for me. So tracing back all these different scholars and different fields of studies and naming out the most outstanding Shia ones is really a magnificent work done by Sayyid Hasan al-Sadr. Sheikh Ziyaniya, anything missed about Ta'sis al-Shia al-Ulum al-Islam?
Another important point that is mentioned in this book, and I should also highlight it, is that the history of Shia and, or we can say the historicity of Shia mm-hmm. school of thought goes back to the time of the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam.
Okay.
I mean, when we trace back the Shia school of thought, we come to this point that Holy Prophet himself named this school of thought as Shia of Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi salatu wasalam. And the evidence of this is the riwayat that are quoted after this ayah, the seventh verse of chapter Al-Bayyinah. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم إن الذين آمنوا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك هم خير البرية. Regarding this verse, A number of riwayat are quoted by both Shia scholars and Sunni scholars that the Holy Prophet pointed out Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi wasalam and told him, Ya Ali, anta wa shi'atuka humul fa'izun.
Yes.
O Ali, you and your followers are the true people who have got salvation and are the best amongst them. And this hadith and riwayat is quoted by both Sunni and Shia scholars. And among Sunnis, for example, I should mention the great scholar Jalaluddin Suyuti, that he quotes this riwayat in his book Ad-Durr al-Manthur. So, and we should mention also this point that Sayyid Hasan Asad was a great muhaddith.
Yes, yes.
A person who was, really
known
prominent.
As muhaddith al-Kazimini.
Yes, he was known even as muhaddith al-Kazimini.
That's right.
To the point that he gave permission of riwayat and quoting riwayat to great figures like late Ayatollah Muhammad Hussein Gharavi al-Isfahani, Sheikh Abbas al-Qumi, rahmatullah alayhi, Sayyid Abu al-Hasan al-Isfahani, the great mujtahid of the Shia school of thought, and also Agha Bozorg Tehrani, that he himself, Agha Bozorg Tehrani, is a brilliant sun in the sky of the scholars of Shia school of thought.
That's all right. A really outstanding, we can say, scholar and outstanding marja, faqih and muhaddis, Sayyid Hasan al-Sad, and the magnum opus of Ta'sis al-Shia al-Ulum al-Islam, which is really an outstanding book regarding different scholars in 14 separate, we can say, fields of studies, especially among the Islamic studies, the pioneers and the initiators of different fields of studies among the Shia ones. This is really outstanding and brilliant, a brilliant work which was done by Sayyid Hasan al-Sad. That's right. Thursday, Rabiul Awwal 11th, 1354. According to the Hijra calendar, this outstanding man, Sayyid Hasan al-Sad, passed away. His body was taken into the holy shrine of Al-Kadhimiyya, and he was buried in one of the rooms or the chambers around the holy shrine of Imam al-Kadhim, and Imam al-Jawad, alayhimus salam, you know, and by the order of Sayyid Abul Hasan al-Isfahani, 3 days were named and titled for commemoration or the mourning sessions for Sayyid Hasan al-Sad, and the Shia world really missed one of the true protectors of the legacy of the Shia world. May Allah bless the soul of Sayyid Hasan al-Sad, the author of Ta'sis al-Shia al-Ulum al-Islam, and thank you, Ma Sheikh Ziyania and Sheikh Mahdavi, to elaborate on his life for us. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information and to download for free our previous episodes, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio, to another episode and introducing another Shia dignitary. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.